Hello everyone, this is Mary Savant, BUFO Radio, and tonight we have with us Peter Moon, and he's going to be speaking with us on the Spandau Mystery. This is his latest book. Hi Peter, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, I'm fine, thank you very much.
Okay, and I want to thank you for having me in your book, Spandau Mystery. Now, where can people find this book at?
Well, the book's available on Amazon.com. It's available in many bookstores and on the website skybooksusa.com.
All right. Now, this is not your only book. You have so many out there. As a matter of fact, we've done it for the listeners. This is Peter's second appearance on our show, and you can find his other interview in our archived shows. So after you listen to this, go on over there and check out that interview. But remember, that one's a membership archive. So burlingtonnews.net/membership. Read up on it and join and enjoy that that interview as well. And for the people that aren't familiar, and very few of them aren't familiar with Peter Moon's work. Peter, you want to tell them about some of the books that you've got out and articles that you find utterly fascinating?
Okay, I'm primarily noted for the Montauk Project Experiments in Time, which is the first book that started my publishing company, Sky Books. And that was, I was the co-author and essentially the ghostwriter for Preston Nichols, which is a book about time travel and mind control experiments that were done with the state-of-the-art radar technology at the time during the 1970s, and they were able to manipulate and, I guess, correlate psychic energy with radio frequency, and they had a big transmitter out at the eastern end of Long Island at Montauk Point, New York. There's an Air Force station out there that was blended in to look like the scenery back in World War II. And there were several experiments, and Preston Nichols was a scientist involved in these experiments. And this was some of the most secret and classified information in the entire military-industrial complex. And he began telling these stories in the later part of the 80s, received a lot of threats, and I was able to help him in getting the work published in 1992. And it's kind of changed the paradigm of how people have looked at, looked at the world ever since. So when I began investigating, trying to verify his claims, because of course, anything that classified and that secret, the documentation has been shredded or, worse. And so I began to, in trying to verify what he said, I couldn't find too much of a paper trail, but I knew people who were involved in it, and I knew there was a trail. I began to experience the phenomena of synchronicity. And so that became the theme of many of my other books, and there were certain themes that popped up in the Montauk Project, one of which was Nazis. Nazis had the biggest enclave on Long Island outside of Germany. There were more Nazis in Long Island, and this is in the 30s.
Now, your book, Spandau Mystery, hits on that.
Oh, yes, that's why I'm leading into that.
Oh, okay.
But I'm just giving some of the background which led to Spandau Mystery. In the 1920s, one out of every seven people in Long Island belonged to the KKK. And the eugenics doctrines were developed at Cold Spring Harbor on Long Island, which was the Nazis, the psychiatrist in Germany actually... not the Nazis, the psychiatrists in Germany co-opted these from Long Island. They were developed by Otto Kahn, one of the wealthiest. He was a Jewish banker, and his wife was the big supporter of the eugenics program in America, and this was transported over to Germany. And when Hitler took power, one of the first things he was basically agreed to do with the German Illuminati or whatnot was to sign those laws that I think they were called the Nuremberg laws that enforced sterilization and basically narrowing down humanity through eugenics. So that was started on Long Island. So there's a long history of funny business on Long Island and Germanic racism on Long Island as well. So that and of course Nazis were reported to have been all over the east end of Long Island, and that was sort of, and I wrote a book about that called The Black Sun. They had Adolf Hitler Boulevard on Long Island as well, and similar names after the Nazis, so it was quite a strong Nazi enclave on Long Island, and this gave way to the association at Montauk Point, New York, and this is kind of where the book, Spandau Mystery, begins. Because for those of you in the audience, many people don't know what Spandau is. There's a duo or something called Spandau Ballet, which is named after Spandau Prison, which is what my book is about. Spandau Prison was a prison of that held seven Nazis that were captured and sentenced after the war. And the most famous prisoner was prisoner number seven, Rudolf Hess, who was the deputy Führer of Germany under Hitler. Now, the other prisoners were let go on, parole. They didn't serve their full sentences. And only Hess, and that prison was huge. It cost hundreds of millions of dollars a year, you know, within four governments, and to keep that prisoner in that prison. We're talking about the French, the British, the U.S., and the Russians. They rotated every 3 months. There would be one guard, and this would cost a tremendous amount of money to keep this one man incarcerated, and even Winston Churchill said he should be released on humanitarian grounds. And Gorbachev was willing to release him. But right when he was about to be released, he ends up mysteriously dead. And this is where my story begins.
And now, the Spandau Mystery actually is your first book that you've ever really done as as fiction, but it's based on nonfiction, right?
That's correct. And the reason it was done as fiction is it was actually told... I was told to do it by a Chinese doctor who put me on her table and started telling me things about myself that I wouldn't, she couldn't know. She's a friend of mine, and she's very, she's a medical doctor, but she uses a form of Chinese acupressure, and it's a gift. And she says, you should write a fiction book. I said, no, I don't want to write a fiction book. She says, you do, it'll do much better. And so I toyed with it, I played around with it. And what I found out was that in writing fiction, it's an attempt, and in this case, is to get at areas that you can't find. You can't go on the internet and look up certain things. You can't go into a library. You can't go on, call your conspiracy, networkers and find out certain information. So when you approach it through the creative process of fiction, you're able to unlock certain maybes and possibilities and when you engage in the creative process, and any artist knows this, you're mimicking life itself. So even though, some of the things are, definitely fabricated, it's an attempt by the conscious mind to arrive at secrets, and boy, did it deliver, because the creative process is a wonderful thing, and it delivers a lot of interesting information which wouldn't have been opened up otherwise.
Now, in your book, Spandau Mystery, you also tap into characters such as Aleister Crowley.
Right. Well, of course, Aleister Crowley had his signature all over the quantum synchronicities I experienced in investigating Montauk. And of course, Montauk is about time travel.
Right.
And Crowley is also, seems to have an association with two of the time travelers from the Montauk legend. So I incorporated him into those in a way to attempt to synthesize and figure out what some of the connections were or might have been.
So, now, as a fiction, you write that in the book, they believe that if he was released, he would be able to give out information that they did not want out. But actually, is it possible that he did have that information that
fiction? That's not fiction. Exactly what information he had and the extent to which it would bother the status quo or the powers that be is debatable. But there was a considerable amount, because they couldn't let him go, because he knew he was the main financial czar of the Nazi Party. He was the one that provided the connections between the Bavarian and Illuminati and all their banking connections and Hitler. And, you know, he was the one who discovered Hitler and who was already working for Army Intelligence when he found him. And with his associations, his connections to the Bavarian Illuminati were through Karl Haushofer. So they were able to orchestrate and help Hitler rise to power. And Hitler, and Hess himself was, he was called Minister Without Portfolio. In other words, he could create laws. None of the other top Nazis could create laws. You know, not Goring, not Goebbels, not Himmler. They weren't, you know, they would have to go through the legislature and whatnot. Only Hess and Hitler could create laws. So that was an extremely powerful position.
What I found interesting was how you connected, it caught me totally off guard on this one, where you connected in your book, The Spandau Mystery, Barry Goldwater.
Well, Barry Goldwater is not only a part of the Montauk legend, he's a part of the Montauk fact detail. Because, and this was never said in any of the books, and
of course for people that don't know, you know, in other countries besides the United States, that's Senator Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, Barry Goldwater was a senator of Arizona, and he lived to a pretty ripe old age, and he was very interested in UFOs. He was a general in the Air Force, and he maintained his general status as a reserve in the U.S. Air Force while he was a senator. He was a candidate for president in 1964. He was known as a conservative, although he wasn't conservative at all by today's standards. And, you know, I had a chance encounter with him in my personal life right after I had ran into, the man who put my parents together on a blind date. I'd ran into him in San Diego when I was a little boy with my parents. I said, you know, I recognize that guy, Dad, and yep, that's him. And then right after that, I ran into Barry Goldwater. He just happened to be, you know, I said, what's the, you know, synchronicities come in cycles. And I said, boy, I didn't realize what that meant, except that years later, he would be an integral part of the Montauk Project investigation. And how that happened was, he had a nephew who, I think, called into a radio program in, I think it was Las Vegas, where Al Bielek was on the radio, and made contact with Al, because, and I don't know exactly how it evolved, I don't remember, but basically, the nephew of Goldwater had, you know, was in touch with his uncle, and he came out to Montauk Point to investigate this Air Force base. And Goldwater did a whole investigation because it was obviously being run by the military, and he was on a commission for the military. And he says there was no traceable funding. Who was operating this base? Why was it going on? I've even heard stories of Goldwater being out there himself and looking around and not being able to find out anything. This is just what you call fiscal responsibility from his position in the Senate. And he couldn't find out anything. And then Preston Nichols and Al Bielek got involved with the nephew. And all of this was done very hush-hush. And, you know, I think Goldwater had finally indicated that it was fine for it to be investigated, but he didn't want to be attached to it for his own, you know, protection. So, I mean, I knew about this for years, and it was, you know, private information. It was not supposed to be publicized. Goldwater's dead now, though. It doesn't really matter. So that was always, he was always honored while he was alive. And it's been released, I think, on tapes by Al Bielek. But that's kind of how Goldwater fits in to the Montauk legend, and that's why he's picked to have a role in the story.
And now, also in the book, I believe, or maybe this is something I'd heard from you before, Preston Nichols at one point in time didn't even remember himself being involved in the Montauk Project. It was memories that came later.
That's correct. That's correct. And he discovered his role in Montauk by people telling him that they recognized him or they knew him out at Montauk. And it came to a head in real life when he was having a dinner with his cousin's family. And his cousin's husband, you know, told him he knew him in Montauk. And they basically had a fight about it. It almost came to physical blows. And this was one of Preston's stories. And at the funeral of Preston's mother, I met his cousin. She's a very beautiful lady, and she was now divorced. The husband disappeared, and she verified the story with me. She said, almost definitely it happened.
And, of course, they naturally tried to discredit his story many times over.
Yeah, and this is one, and you will find many pockets of truth with Preston Nichols. Sometimes he's an eccentric person, he's a genius, and he's not really concerned about, you know, details. So sometimes he misfires, but then, you know, he might say two things to make him misfire, and then you'll see something that makes the truth of what he's saying incontrovertibly true. So,
well, you know, that's kind of understandable as far as I'm concerned, after what he's been through, because he actually did travel himself, didn't he?
Well, yes, and there is always a, you know, mind-messing element that goes with that, and people have said to me, they say, well, you know, there's no better place to hide the truth than Preston Nichols because, you know, certain things are going to come out askew, so what a better place to hide the truth. But, you know, he can speak very coherently. He's very, very engaging and very intelligent man, one of the most intelligent people you'll ever meet.
In your book, you talk about, I think, that Preston Nichols was involved with a particular chair that the people would sit in, and they'd be able to, the government would be able to create some sort of a reality or project a manifestation based on the thoughts.
That's
of that
correct.
Person?
That's correct. It's called the Montauk Chair, and essentially what that was a lounge chair in its beginning stages, and it was had sets of, well, I guess what you'd call esoteric receivers, and, you know, crystal receivers that were designed to receive and then amplify the psychic energy of the person sitting in the chair. It's, to pick up his thoughts and literally, by amplifying them, projecting them outward into the environment. So if you had the person sitting in the chair thinking of mayhem, it might cause mayhem in the local community. If you had them thinking of peace and love, it might cause that effect on the local community. So that's essentially what that was, and as you get more sophisticated and specific in being able to amplify that energy, you can project time into that equation. When you project time, that was literally what led to the creation of changing time and vortexes and whatnot. It was quite a esoteric and complicated procedure.
Now that, hold on, just had somebody walk into the office. Hold it. Hold on just.
That's not somebody, that's a dog.
Okay, sorry about that. Now, this, when they would put these people in a chair, they could tap into their mind and actually put that data somehow recorded into the computer. Am I correct on that? So that they could store it for later use?
Well, exactly, and what you have is you have people
like in files of some sort.
Yeah. Well, what they did basically, according to the stories and legends, was literally open a vortex into another world, and they would send people and TV equipment into that and transmit back because if you can go into a vortex,
no.
You can transmit back through the vortex.
You can go into another time? Is this what you're saying?
This is what the story is all about, is
right.
opening up vortexes. There's a description in the book, The Montauk Project, of how they opened up the vortexes. And, you know, with using the psychics, using amplifying the energy, and it takes a certain amount of power. So basically, you know, once you have a vortex opened up and you send somebody through it, you can also send signals back through it. And that was the, theory behind the, infinite TV screens that are portrayed in Spandau Mystery of different times and different places, and it's tapping into,
Well, they say sometimes fiction is stranger than... Nonfiction is stranger than fiction.
Yeah, truth is stranger than fiction, most definitely.
To the average person, reading a book such as this, they'd had a difficult time even comprehending, the concept behind that.
I don't know. It's written to as science fiction, and it's written to be fun as well.
Right.
It's written to have plausible truth, but it's also meant to be a lot of fun
for
the reader.
But the problem is with it, it's true.
Well, some
right?
of it's true. Some of it's true. I mean, some of it is clearly fiction, but it's based.
But it's based on a truth that these vortexes, they were opening up vortexes, and having time travelers and projecting information back into the present.
Yes, it's very important to remember that we are, as spiritual beings, we're entirely capable of incredible feats. I think it's even said in the Bible by Christ, that you are capable of greater things than I am, and this is an understatement, because we do not have to be subject to all of the dominion that we're subject to in this realm, and so there's a lot of things going on by secret projects and whatnot that are designed to, the whole conspiracy paradigm, but it's also possible to bust out of these things, and that's, using the 90% of your brain that is basically unknown, and that's in part what this book is, an exploration thereof.
Right. Right now, or back then as it stood, government is trying to achieve something through technology that we're actually able to achieve through sheer mind power, right?
I would agree with that, yes. And the technology is, all technology is ever going to do, it's going to mimic the ability of the Creator. It's going to mimic it.
And of course, what you said, like what Christ promised, as long as we have the faith of a mustard seed, we can perform the same miracles or even greater than Him.
That's right. We're not all used to clapping our hands and having a dinner appear, but there are people that can do that through servants, and there are people that can do that through disincarnate spirits, sometimes referred to as the jinn. And but what I'm saying, the best technology can do is mimic the efforts of creation. And sometimes those are good and convenient. Sometimes they've gotten the better of us.
Listeners, you're listening to Mary Sutherland, BUFO Radio, and I'm speaking with Peter Moon. And he put this book out, Spandau Mystery. And I cannot begin to even come close to tell you how much I want you to get this book and read it. I know one of our listeners from Holland actually bought this book already, and he's read it, and his name's Ted. I don't know if he bought it directly from you or if he went through the publisher, but this book is an eye opener, a mind opener. It's food for thought, based on a truth, although it's written as a fiction. But I sat here reading this book, and I was, you know, I was supposed to be working away, and people would just sit me, and very seldom they ever see me do this, but they'd see me sit back off in a corner someplace, you know, just continually reading this book, because it's a fascinating book. And I think it was a book that was due right at this point in time, because this happened how many years ago? I mean, just I know, of course, like you said, it's a fiction, but even the fiction was based on what year?
Well, approximately. With Rudolf Hess dying in 1987, he died at the age of 93 in 1987.
Right.
August. I think it was August 17th.
And in it, okay, so in the late 80s, we, our government, through the Montauk Project and similar things, through working with Rudolf Hess and some of the mysteries that they had discovered in the pyramid, the Tibetan mysteries, the various governments have been having pretty much hands-on as far as experimentation of time travel, dimensional travel, for every since the late 80s. And if they were able to accomplish what they accomplished then, imagine what they've accomplished by now.
Well, exactly. And you know, I guess what you'd say, interference or invasion or influence upon human life has taken place from the beginning. You know, if you go through history, and the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Syrians, it's all, you know, prone to influence and manipulation by outside forces, whether these are, you know, ETs, aliens, angels, whatever you want to say. There's a strong history of outside influence in mankind. One of which is the story of the birth of Christ in the Bible, which plays very much like an abduction. You know, something comes in and stimulates her seed, and it's God, the Holy Spirit, but it mimics the exact story of what takes place in abductions of UFOs. I'm not making a comment on what's true and what not here. It's just that the stories run in tandem, hauntingly similar.
It seems like this runs in cycles, doesn't it? Where it seems like there's certain elite groups in power that seek not only to claim our bodies, which is bad enough physically, but they actually attempt to control or manipulate or possess our very soul.
Yes, that's what's called dominion. There are jinn, or spirits of dominion, and this is, when you come into this world, you find out that things run based upon money and based upon nature, and this is the realm of dominion, and dominion is where it comes from, the word God, dominique, mm-hmm. domination. So you have to deal with that factor as a living creature in the physical plane. And then, there's also something called free will, which competes with dominion. Free will does what it wants to do.
But unfortunately, thanks to books like yours, because people out there, most of them haven't a clue, of what's going on around them. They think that they have free will. They think that their thoughts are their own. They've been told, there's not such thing as UFOs, that, at one point in time they were told that the Earth was only 5,000 years old. It was flat and, all
the
various things.
If they have free will, they can go to Burger King or McDonald's.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And they become very comfortable with that. They become very pacified, like sheep. And in the meantime, this elitist group becomes stronger and stronger, and the people out there lose more and more and more of their own.
So it would appear. So it would appear. It would appear that these elitist groups you're referring to are stronger than ever. Right now we have an administration that is insisting upon executive privilege in an unprecedented and, you know, over-aggressive way. It's, you know, incredibly impudent, according to the, you know, the Congress. And, you know, so it would appear that we have extreme, you know, prejudice against free will. At the same time, and with the oil companies and all this, but at the same time, we have a citizenry, what would appear to be a small percentage of the citizenry that has woken up to these facts and has been able to describe it and document it in a way that's not really been done, at least for the last 2,000 years.
Right.
So, you know, it's a funny paradigm where you have this horrible situation, yet you have an expose of the situation and a relative freedom to expose the situation. You know, it's not enough to change the status quo all that much, but it's a very interesting time we live in, because I agree with you. It seems like it's worse than ever, yet the truth has been revealed to those who wish to sniff it out. So it all comes to what many people believe is a very critical time. Are we going to make it? And the answer to that is, you know, some will and some won't. How many make it and how many don't is, you know, it's better determined by bookmakers.
The truth shall set you free.
Right.
Well, you know, speaking about truth, and you've been working on this too, is the history of the United States is completely falsified, and you're working on a new book.
That's right.
Going to be exposing even more of false history.
Right, and the falsification is such that one can't even begin by talking about it, because if it was all put into a book, nobody'd believe it anyway. It's like you can only take what's palatable. You know, you need to refer to Columbus. If you were to write the whole history of the United States pre-Columbian, it would be totally upside down from what you've been told. But we need to reference Columbus. We need to reference certain place names in history, because if we don't, the reader will be completely lost. We start calling them by their original place names and where they came from, and if you can't culturally identify with that, it makes it very difficult going. So, and I even get lost, because I know people that, you know, have studied this history, and they will be the first to agree they don't always sound so coherent, because you can't identify with what they're saying unless you've been steeped in the knowledge.
I know, I catch myself here, you know, as people come in and into our, because we have an Earth Mysteries Museum here too, and they'll start asking me questions, and I forget who I'm speaking with, you know, and I'll just start rattling on, you know, various things, and all of a sudden I'll stop and I'll look, and they're standing there with their eyes glazed over, you know, totally lost in what I'm talking about. You have to stop and slow down and find a reference point, like you said, and try what, you know, it's like baby steps, one step at a time. Let them figure out one thing, and once they feel comfortable with that, then you go with the next step.
Exactly, and one of the things I think I should touch on here is one of the theories proposed by the book is it creates a completely plausible scenario on how World War II was fought over Tibet.
Yeah, very. I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you.
Yeah, because there was a strong Nazi connection to Tibet. And if you've looked at the shows on the History Channel, you see those are SS films that were in Tibet. The Dalai Lama himself was tutored by a member of the SS, and there was a strong Nazi connection there. And you know, the CIA, who was in bed with the Nazis, helped the Dalai Lama escape in the 50s under the persecution. In opposition to the persecution of Red China. But essentially, the connection I have with in the book is I go into the Karl Haushofer connection, who was a Bonpo priest of the Tibetan Lamas. And he was connected to Hess. He was Hess's mentor. And then you had Ian Fleming,
yeah,
who was a German, fluent in German, and had hung out in the same occult societies. He was also into international banking, and he was in British intelligence, and he was working with Crowley. He was very close to Crowley, Ian Fleming, and he was also knowledgeable about the Philadelphia experiment, as you know, was supposed to come over to New Jersey and brief his fellow intelligence friend, Ivan Sanderson, who was a friend of Al Bielek. This is how we know this. But it was the Duke of Hamilton, his name, don't remember his name, it was Clydesdale, but he was known as the Duke of Hamilton. He flew over Mount Everest, and in that flight, what I have in the book, is he sees the Drogba, the remains of the Drogba civilization, which is in western Tibet, when he flies over Everest. And that's a whole ancient civilization that literally is there. Now, I don't know if he saw it in real life, but it's hard to imagine that he didn't. And when he came back, he reported on it to the Houseovers, the British intelligence. Now, he knew the Houseovers. He knew Albrecht. He was very close with Albrecht Houseover. And it's been, if you read Albrecht, who's the son of Karl Houseover, Karl is the mentor of Hess, and Albrecht is his son. Now, if you read, I've read the letters of Albrecht Houseover to Hamilton, and the way he describes them, sounds very much like there's a gay relationship between the two of them, which is very common in British nobility. And when you read this and you see that he would have, and Albrecht Houseover was the one who kind of pulled the curtain down on the Nazi Party. He was part of the assassination attempt at Hitler. And he was killed right at the end of the war. Himmler had him killed. Himmler was actually his friend, but he had to kill him because Himmler could have been implicated in the attempted assassination of Hitler. So basically, you have this, you know, busy situation over Tibet, and of course, there were. Civilization I'm talking about was an ancient civilization that are known as the Drogba, and the Drogba claimed to have come from and, you know, had a crash landing in a spaceship, and they were mixed hybrid with the local population, and this might explain, they were little people, and this might explain the little people that are shown on the SS films that on the History Channel. They only show a snippet of the little people, they're like miniature little people. And of course, I use that little people element in the book as well. So you know, Tibet is, the British wanted it very badly, you know, before the war. There's a lot of interesting facts surrounding Tibet that are included in the book.
Yeah, it. But then there was something else I wanted to ask you on that one. But it totally slipped my mind.
Was it John Birch?
Yeah. Thank you.
John Birch, everybody's heard of the John Birch Society, but few people know who Birch was. And Birch was the first, he's considered the first casualty of the Cold War. He was killed after the war ended in China because he refused to put down his weapons when the Red Chinese told him to. And of course, he was with the winning Americans and didn't feel he had to. And the way the story's been rendered is that it sounded like he was, you know, vehemently opposed to listening to the Chinese, when just cooperating with them would have saved his life. And if he ate a little bit of dirt, he would have been able to stay alive. And this is the story that we've been told. But Birch was a minister, a fundamentalist-type minister that grew up in Georgia. And he was spreading the gospel in China. And he learned the native language, and when World War II broke out, he was patriotic, and he acted as an interpreter. And he saved Jimmy Doolittle when Jimmy Doolittle did his bombs over Tokyo, and they had the planes weren't enough to go back to wherever they came from. So they had to land in China and hope on an escape, and China was in Japanese hands at that time, and John Birch was able to, through his to go in and rescue Doolittle through his, you know, manipulation of the individuals, the Chinese, and knowing the language. He rescued Doolittle, and he got promoted to the virtual head of the OSS and the head of Army Intelligence in China. And he used to send the Flying Tigers. He was over the Flying Tigers, which is, you know, now known as the CIA's private air force. And back then in the Army, they were the Flying Tigers, and they did several missions over Western China. So we don't really know what they did in Western China. They've been connected to dope rings, but dope is not necessarily connected to Western China. It's more this ancient mysterious civilization. So I hypothesized that this was a part of the John Birch mythos, and of course he was the perfect instrument to make a society out of, because it's a, you know, it's all kind of a red herring. He was fighting communism, but he probably had to be killed for his knowledge of all this. He was a very powerful person by reason of the knowledge he would have had in just over the events in Western China, which was ancient Tibet.
Well, one other thing I wanted to bring up before we close this show, and that was in your book, The Spandau Mystery, with Peter Moon, and you can go to skybooksusa.com to get this book, but you had brought up that there was a group that had actually sat down and designed the plan of World War I, World War II, and World War III.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, and so this was, so all of this is, you know, it's already, it had been in World War I, all three wars has actually been in play, you know, planned out for a very long time.
Well, yes, and I've heard this, you know, if you study, I mean, you know, if you study enough conspiracy, you'll see where it's actually, the players will even admit to it if you catch them in the right, you know, right sound bite, so to speak.
And what is their purpose for World War I, II, and III? Do you know?
It's just, you know, control. Control and manipulation. It's if you can imagine, you know, having a wife that you wanted to, or a husband that you wanted to keep in line, you know, you wanted to own and control them. And it's called mastery of other people. And it's very easy to master another, but it doesn't accomplish anything. The true art of living is to master yourself. And these people that are so obsessed with mastering another are not really mastering anything. It's all about enslavement. And we live in a world that is preoccupied with enslavement, and one could even argue that we have a universe that's preoccupied with enslavement. You know, you've got to, you know, it's like you can't push a button and turn it all off. You've got to, you know, you're a slave to your body. You've got to make it sleep. You've got to make it eat.
In the Spandau Mystery, you went in to Crowley going to Montauk and being able to jump through these various doorways into the past.
Well, yes, I did, and that was part of, you know.
And what I think I'm getting at probably is sometimes I don't even know myself what I'm getting at, but there's various doorways all over the world where people can, I guess, portal jump, would you call it?
Well, yeah, and that is a very fictionalized version of portal jumping. I have him do there. You know, putting him in different environments and whatnot, which is, you know, he's a fun character to play with.
And do you think that people have to do this consciously, or do you think that there's many of us doing it on a regular basis without even realizing
it? Well, there's no question. There's many people doing it, people that are in insane asylums and people that aren't in insane asylums, and I'm not suggesting that they need to be put in asylums. People have experiences from different domains, and it, you know, scientifically there's many other dimensions and domains outside of the one we're in. So, you know, if one just can kind of tilt their spirit, you know, so many degrees, they might have a whole other rush of experiences. And when they're rather insignificant to this world unless they connect to this world. So there is an interconnectivity. All things connect. So when they become relevant to this world, that's when it's interesting. Say suppose the Roswell crash, which has recently been celebrated with the 60th anniversary, suppose that happens, and suppose it creates a whole different structure of government and a whole reaction by the government, which it obviously did. So that's coming from another world. And when these things begin to, you know, interconnect, you know, then they have to be accounted for and paid attention to. It. You know, that's just one example.
Okay, and now you're going to be at the Temple of Saqqara conference in Michigan in August?
That's right, in Allegan, Michigan, at the home of Mary and Dean Hardy, which, you know, they have a pyramid on their property, and it's a very interesting pyramid. It was built for their son and after a trip to Egypt. And they have been very, I guess, passionate about it. They've written a book on pyramid energy. And I will be there with Artie Crippen, Red Medicine of the Montauk Indians, and Chief Tecumseh Brown Eagle of the Erie Mound Builders. And the three of us will be traveling together to Michigan on the weekend of August 10th, I think it's 10th, 11th, 12th. I know it's the in honor of the August 12th date of the Montauk and Philadelphia Project. So we will be there. I think it's Friday the 10th is our first day there.
And, of course, listeners, I'm going to be there as well. So anyone that is going to the Temple of Saqqara conference, look for yours truly, Mary Sutherland, and Artie, and Tecumseh, and Peter Moon. So, and again, I highly, highly, highly recommend this book, The Spandau Mystery, Peter Moon. Again, skybooksusa.com. And also, I talked to Frank Joseph, Frank Joseph, and he's going to be doing a show with Peter Moon. So that's a show to be looking forward to. And I would imagine they're going to be tapping into the history, the true history of the United States. So who knows what these guys are going to be talking about, but I'll be joining in on their conversation, and you guys will have the opportunity to listen. So, and maybe even I'll open up the lines a little bit for you guys to crawl into. So, and thank you so much, Peter Moon, Spandau Mysteries, and looking forward to seeing you in August as well.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye.